Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated September 10. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Top of the fold, first page, Fidelity looks to buy big and in an expansion site by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Research Triangle Park. Fidelity Investments has decided to buy an existing office campus vacated by Nortel Networks instead of building its own campus in Research Triangle Park as was envisioned from when the firm moved into the market 5 years ago. A spokesman for Fidelity Investment confirms that the building is negotiating to buy the four office buildings at the Network Center campus in RTP, formerly owned and occupied by Nortel Networks. The deal value is expected to top $40 million. Boston-based Fidelity employs about 2,200 people in the Triangle, with office space leased at five buildings on four campuses in RTP, in Durham, and in Cary. In RTP, the lease space is in two of the four buildings at Network Center the company is now negotiating to buy. The leased buildings were meant to be a temporary solution until the company could build its own $100 million campus in RTP. Fidelity bought 268 acres of lakeside property in the park in 2006, with plans to complete the campus by 2011. But construction never began. Nortel Networks, meanwhile, filed for bankruptcy protection in 2009 and rejected its long-term lease contract for space in the Network Center buildings on Chapel Hill-Nelson Highway. The telecommunications company still occupies the 754,000-square-foot Gateway Center campus on Davis Drive. It shares the space with its former Enterprise Solutions division that was acquired by Avaya. Nortel built the buildings in the late 1990s and sold them to the European investment fund Zurich Structured Finance in 2001. Nortel subleased two of the Network Center buildings to Fidelity, but the remaining two buildings are still vacant. Fidelity's purchase of the campus would allow the financial firm to consolidate its Triangle staff onto one site and still have room to grow, says Fidelity spokesman Vincent Laporcio. We recently completed a review of our real estate portfolio and made the strategic business decision to pursue the four buildings in RTP, he says. Network Center provides us with a significant amount of office space to accommodate our real estate needs for now and in the future. Fidelity already leases about 600,000 square feet of office space in the region. Network Center's four buildings have a combined 676,000 square feet of space, according to the property's management firm, C.B. Richard Ellis of Raleigh. Head leasing executive for the property, Ed Pulliam, declined to comment about the pending sale, and a spokesperson for Zurich did not return calls for comment. Laporcio adds that the pending Network Center property purchase is subject to contingencies before a deal can be completed within the next few weeks. At that time, he says, the company will begin discussions with the Research Triangle Foundation about what to do with the 268 acres of undeveloped land Fidelity owns in the park. It's premature to say what will happen right now, but because of this new opportunity, we would not be developing the other land in RTP, he says. We will be working with RTP to find other options. The Research Triangle Foundation is the owner and operator of RTP, and it has the right of first refusal to buy back any property available for sale within the park's 7,000 acres. Chris Mulder, Director of Marketing and Communications for RTP, says the future of the Fidelity's 268 acres of undeveloped land in RTP is still in discussions. At this point in time, we know they are still going through negotiations, but from the foundation standpoint, we are thrilled they made the further commitment to invest in RTP, Mulder says. Bringing all their employees to one campus is a great opportunity. Next up, Leitner Group lands sixfold profit with sale by Monica Chin from Durham. Former Duke University basketball standout Christian Leitner and his partners in West Village have sold one building from the downtown Durham development. And here's the clincher. They sold the building for more than six times its assessed value. The Research Lab building, an empty, unrenovated building at 710 West Main Street at the corner of Main and Duke Streets, was last assessed at the start of 2011 for $1.49 million. On August 17th, it was sold for $9.65 million to a partnership made up of HCP Incorporated, a Long Beach, California real estate investment trust, and Longfellow Real Estate Partners, a Boston-based developer that specializes in build-outs for life science companies. That breaks down to HCP Longfellow paying about $183 per square foot for a vacant building. Representatives of the companies did not respond to requests for comment. 52,609 square foot research lab building had been leased by Duke University since 2007 for an undisclosed amount. The university will continue to lease the building under the new ownership, says Scott Seelig, Duke Associate Vice President of Capital Assets and Real Estate. Renovations in the building are expected to begin in a few months. We are in discussion on how to develop the property. It'll probably be a different use, Seelig says. We may sublease the building. Duke also leases the building next door, 700 West Main Street, where it has its Office of Durham and Regional Affairs. The sale of the research lab signals that West Village Partners are moving forward with selling off pieces of the property. Since fall 2010, Leitner and his former Duke teammate Brian Davis and Durham developer Tom Neiman have been shopping the campus to potential buyers. Leitner and Neiman did not return requests for comment. From the looks of dozens of filings in the Durham County Register of Deeds, Leitner and his partnerships have been consolidating ownerships from numerous West Village entities. Phase 1 Properties has largely consolidated under an entity by lender Federal Capital Partners based in Washington, D.C. Some of the maneuvering signal that HCP and Longfellow might be interested in more than just the research lab. Around the time of the sale of Research Lab, the partnership took on an $11.1 million in a promissory note held by one West Village entity, struck an easement agreement on the 700 West Main building next door, struck a deal up on the 159 parking spaces in the Fuller Street parking deck, and made a subordination agreement with the three additional West Village entities. HCP Longfellow agreed to provide upon reasonable request of noteholder, and in any case every 30 days after the commencement of any Phase 1 renovation work and Phase 2 tenant improvements, reports from an architect or professional engineer with respect to the progress of such work, end quote, they stated in one filing. It sounds like this is an REIT that's sitting on some money and looking to invest it in something other than bonds, says Bill Kakoff, president of Downtown Durham Incorporated. It sounds like they're trying to lock up some paperwork so they can do some real due diligence so they can eventually pull the trigger and buy some buildings. Any sales could impact another West Village project just across the street. The 337,000-square-foot Chesterfield building, located across Main Street from the research lab, was formerly planned to be Phase 3 of West Village. After Leitner and his partners lost the building to a creditor in 2010, Chesterfield was snapped up by Durham developer Josh Parker. Parker has an ambitious plan to turn Chesterfield into apartments, ground-level retail and office space. Although he has lined up $63 million in recovery zone bonds, the closing on the building has been delayed until the end of September. Parker had been negotiating with Leitner for 230 parking spaces for the Chesterfield project and has an agreement in place for parking spots with Richard Morgan, owner of Morgan Imports. The offer to lease spaces is still outstanding, Parker says. We're still hoping towards a closing and hoping to get it done as soon as possible. This week's lead article on the front page is entitled A Changed World by Jason DeBruin. Since America's freedoms seemed threatened on September 11, 2001, the very concept of freedom has moved to front row seating in the national psyche. Since that day, freedoms have bumped up against one another. A Florida pastor burned the Muslim holy book, the Quran, in a nation founded on the concept of free religious thought. Many Americans consent each day to having their bodies searched for weapons, while others lobby for relaxed control on weapons. Since 9/11, shifts have occurred in nearly every aspect of American life and even the psychological makeup of the country's residents. It's what David Schnauzer, director of Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in Durham, calls a clash of civilization thinking. Schnauzer says such thinking even penetrates political discourse, pointing to Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain saying he would not be comfortable with a Muslim in his cabinet and that Islam is not a religion deserving of protection under the First Amendment. The changes have been long developing and often subtle, much different than the national mood in the days immediately following the terrorist attacks. Then, Americans look to one another for comfort, says Barbara Friedrichsen, professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We learned a lot about people from those tragic events, she says. One of the biggest urges people had was just to come together. Even as people felt sad, scared, or anxious, they also felt inspired and hopeful, Friedrichsen says. It's that mix of the positive with the negative that allows people to bounce back. Such an inspiration gave rise to two wars and the creation of a bulbous federal bureaucracy aimed at, that word again, protecting America's freedom. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security was created in 2002 and now has 230,000 workers and a $57 billion budget. That's up from the original budget of $22 billion. The work of the DHS is most visible at the nation's airports, where TSA screeners are ubiquitous. The terrorist attacks, quote, clearly affected airports and air travel and aviation throughout the world, end quote, says John Brantley, director of Raleigh-Durham International Airport. The clash for freedoms became a debate on a global stage when it became known that interrogation techniques held anathema by American tradition, torture, were being used by the U.S. government. Many decried the practice. Some continue to support it. Race relations have become strained, and Muslim Americans perceive a stronger anti-Muslim bias from both their day-to-day interactions and the media, according to research from the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security. As the country presses through the longest war in its history in Afghanistan, the effects continue to impact citizens in different ways. Some protest it vehemently, saying it's a waste of life and money. Still, soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen march off, proclaiming their pledge to protect America's freedoms. The events of 9/11 changed America and Americans, and the psychological impacts will linger even past any physical rebuilding. For better or worse, Americans now see the world through post-9/11 lenses. Next up, after spiking, fares level off for RDU flyers, by Chris Bagley. From Morrisville, airfares have leveled off and perhaps even eased down a bit since steep increases in the spring, as penny-pinching travelers stay home and opt for cheaper transportation. Beset by rising fuel costs earlier this year, airlines raised ticket prices in several rounds between January and May. But oil prices have fallen appreciably since July, and ticket prices have begun to follow, as evidenced most recently by a wide variety of special fares that Southwest Airlines was offering through September 8th. One-way flights from Raleigh-Durham International Airport to Philadelphia and several other destinations were as cheap as $59. A composite price that FareCompare.com creates from airfares from 50 large U.S. airports rose from $302 on August 31, 2010, to $368 in mid-March, not typically a time for high prices, but that figure fell back to $337 in the last 2 weeks of August. They'll probably overcook pricing in the first part of the year, FareCompare CEO Rick Sheeney says. AAA, the nonprofit membership group for drivers and other travelers, cited the increase from last year's airfares the week before Labor Day, when in explaining its forecast that Labor Day travel would shift substantially away from airlines and toward cars. AAA is projecting a decrease in the number of Labor Day travelers as some Americans react to recent economic uncertainty and increasing airfares, Glenn McDonald, director of AAA services, said last month. Passenger numbers at RDU have been down slightly this summer, most notably among the airport's two leading carriers, Southwest and Delta Airlines. Southwest flew about 89,000 passengers out of the airport in July, and Delta carried about 60,500. Both totals were down about 10% from last year, according to airport statistics. Meanwhile, American Airlines and several small regional carriers reported increases, and RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin says the airport's Labor Day travel numbers were little changed from last year. Shaney says demand for airline tickets remains fairly healthy and could improve further due to the easing of fares. Meanwhile, Southwest is in the process of consolidating market power as it incorporates AirTran Airways, an Atlanta-based airline it purchased earlier this year. The carrier has said it will begin Southwest flag flights from Atlanta in February to several cities, including Chicago. AirTran now offers several daily flights between RDU and Atlanta. Prices in late September will start around $160. Southwest is selling round-trip tickets to New York LaGuardia International Airport starting at $190. Southwest hasn't announced plans for any changes at Raleigh-Durham, and representatives of the Dallas-based airline didn't respond to requests for comment. Still on the inside of the magazine today, Pharma Drug Shift Seen from Niche to General Practice by Monica Chin from Raleigh. Big Pharma is signaling a shift in strategy in which it will focus more on getting to market primary care medicines while scaling back on niche treatments such as oncology drugs. In Dealmakers Intentions, a report produced by Raleigh-based Campbell Alliance, respondents from 126 life science companies indicated that while licensing deals for niche treatments are expected to decline in 2011, deals on primary care treatments are expected to increase. Oncology deals in 2010 made up about 24% of total deals. In 2011, oncology deals are expected to make up about 20%. By contrast, deals in primary care areas are expected to be up in 2011. Dermatology, from 5% in 2010 to 8% in 2011. Metabolics, from 4% to 8%. And antibiotics, from 4% to 6%. When we probed further, the large pharma said, "We're not interested in large market products. We're looking for niche patient populations within those large categories that would help us follow niche specialties," says James Forte, a spokesman for Campbell. For instance, Avastin targets multiple tumor types. They're looking to be very focused in patient populations within large markets. There were further differences between the expectations of Big Pharma and early-stage life science companies in licensing deals. In 2011, in Phase 3 deals, just slightly more in licensors than out licensors are expecting that the volume of deals will increase. For Phase 2, however, many more out licensors are expecting that the deal volume will increase. The remarkable surge in in-licensors expectations for Phase 2 deals that was seen last year may also have been triggered by the need to refill the Phase 2 pipeline, coupled with the recognition of the difficulty of counting on the later stage deal-making, the report says. The greatest number of respondents anticipating an increasing level of deal-making activity to occur in early stage products. Half of all respondents expect an increase in deal activity for Phase 1 and preclinical products compared with 44% for Phase 2 and 33% for Phase 3, the report says. However, Henry Nowak, assistant director at UNC Chapel Hill's Office of Technology Development, says the results of the survey runs counter to the trend he's seeing. Licensing from Big Pharma has been on the decline. Quote, "I'm not seeing as much people trying to license things for niche markets," Novak says. "One of the biggest trends I'm finding is that from large pharma, there's less of an interest in new products. They're trying to expand geographically. They're trying to expand a compound and broaden its use. They're very risk-averse right now," end quote. A tough financing environment for life science and companies means that more startups are also looking toward grant for seed funding. You need to establish yourself as a real legitimate company. Once you get a little momentum going, then you can maybe get someone interested in common sources of financing, Nowak says. "We're seeing a lot of people licensing from us and trying to do a startup. They'll try to find somebody out in the community who can help them out." Next up, Karmanos finds investors selling 8% Cain's stake by Jason DeBrun from Raleigh. Carolina Hurricanes owner Pete Karmanos says he has secured a group of half a dozen individuals to invest more than $20 million in the team in exchange for a collective 8% ownership stake. Karmanos says the investment must gain approval from the National Hockey League and finish legal paperwork before he will reveal their identities. A consultant hired by Karmanos values the team at $240 million, which is significantly more than the $162 million value estimated by Forbes magazine in December. Names including Jim Goodman, CEO of Capital Broadcasting Company, Matthew Suslik, former Red Hat CEO, and Bob Ingram, former vice chairman of GlaxoSmithKline, are believed to be involved in the deal, but Karmanos would not confirm any of them as investors. In July, Karmanos said he was looking for as many as 12 investors who would collectively own as much as 25% of the team. To lure the investors he has lined up, Karmanos promised them a 3.5% annualized return if they decided to get out after 5 years. But he says that had at most a minimal impact on investors. It just made people feel better, he says. Whether you are doing it for that reason or not, you like to have some guarantee. Sports economists agree. Typically, owners of professional sports franchises are not seeking the greatest financial return on investment, says Robert Reif, member of the law firm Epstein Becker Green, who concentrates on corporate and transactional law in the firm's Washington, D.C. office. They'll do it because they are really interested in the team. That includes visits to the locker room, parties with the team, and just a higher level of fandom. Karmanos also offered perks, including travel with him to 4 road games during a season and business cards with minority owner title. It's all those intangibles, Reese says. It's what sports investing is really all about. It's not a return on investment. Still, the guaranteed financial return is nice. That sounds like a product of the times, Raymond Sewer says, economics and sports professor at Clemson University. Remarks of Karmanos guaranteed return provision. 5 years ago, something like that would have been unheard of because the team would appreciate in value more than 3.5% each year, he says. Forbes, for one, estimates that the value of the Hurricanes declined 9% between 2009 and 2010 seasons. But the cumulative value of all 30 NHL franchises has grown to 145% of their collective values relative to 2001, according to information from Allen & Company, which helps Karmanos put together an offer sheet for potential investors. As for revenue, the NHL grew to a record $2.9 billion in the 2010-11 season, according to the report, the fifth consecutive season of revenue growth. Regardless of numbers placed by one entity or another, the true value is in what someone is willing to pay for it, as is the case with any asset, says Reif. Basically, it comes down to what would a willing buyer pay, he says. Outside factors like a lockout on the National Basketball Association and a new $2 billion television deal between the NHL and NBC likely had little or no effect on those who invested in the Canes to do so, says Sauer. The thinking about the NBA lockout is that some sports-hungry fans may turn to hockey for the lack of big league basketball. The NBA lockout may cancel part of the upcoming season, but it's not going to do anything more than that, Sauer says. You have to look at 2012 and forward, which is what matters, and these effects will not be long-lasting. And now a big sale. In major online auctions, some Triangle properties could go for dimes on the dollar. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Durham. For a collection of Triangle retail and office properties on the brink of foreclosure, October 6 could be judgment day. National auction company, auction.com, will offer for sale one office building in Wake Forest and the lender notes for 5 other properties in Durham, Raleigh, and Cary. They could end up selling for dimes on the dollar by the time the 18-day online auction concludes on October 6th. In North Carolina, 38 properties are listed among the more than 325 buildings and land parcels across the southeastern U.S. that are valued at more than $2 billion and will be made available during the auction. Almost all of the local buildings have been on a watch list of distressed properties for several months as tracked by commercial mortgage data company TREP LLC. That includes 5 office buildings in North Durham known as the Durham Summit Office Park, that were sold to a group of 35 investors from around the country in 2007. The Durham's Summit buildings were 73% vacant as of the second quarter of 2011, after the park's anchor tenant, Duke University, decided to vacate 3 of the buildings shortly after the buildings were sold. A civil lawsuit filed against the seller, Highwood Properties of Raleigh, and its broker, Grubb & Ellis Thomas Linderman Graham of Raleigh, was dismissed in North Carolina Business Court in July, but the Durham Summit owners are still pursuing a lawsuit against the International Grubb & Ellis Company real estate firm, alleging breach of contract and negligent misrepresentation, among other charges. The starting bid for the note on the Durham Summit buildings is set at $1.5 million. The buildings had an outstanding loan balance of $26 million in August, according to Tripp. Still, troubles are more the exception than the rule for most properties in the Triangle, says Bob Holkill, Senior Vice President of Grand Bridge Real Estate Company in Raleigh. Low short-term interest rates are bailing out a lot of problems, Holkill says. More often than not, the ones who are in trouble were the very thinly capitalized developers. Trepp data shows that delinquent loans make up 5.2% of the Triangle's market total loan balance for properties with commercial mortgage-backed securities, or CMBS, loans. Nationally, the delinquency rate in August was 9.5%. A loan is considered delinquent when it is 90 days or more past due. Most of the lender notes that will be available through the auction.com event starting September 19th are at least 90 days past due on their mortgage payments, says Max Suki, a spokesman for auction.com. For each individual foreclosure, it's a huge nightmare for the lender, Suki explains. An interested investor can purchase the note, and they can either renegotiate with the owner of the property or immediately begin foreclosure on their own. At the foundation of all is that they do see potential in a property or they wouldn't be interested. Some of the properties on auction.com's list may not even make it to the sale. The four-building Somerset Office Park in North Raleigh was expected to start its bidding at $10.5 million, but the buildings have since been taken out of the auction portfolio. The 12,700-square-foot former Ruby Reed Child Development Center building in Wake Forest is listed through auction.com with a starting bid of $300,000. But the broker representing the owner of the building says it could sell before the end of the month. Scott Hadley of NAI Carolantic Realty says he has been marketing the Wake Forest building for $895,000 since SunTrust Bank took over the property in February. And he says a potential buyer could put it under contract before the end of the week. A lot of people have looked at the building, but for some it was just too big. Others, they just didn't have the money, he said. It's a good building and it will serve someone's purpose. Other Triangle properties in the auction.com portfolio include the Harvest Plaza Shopping Center on Strickland Road in North Raleigh with a starting bid of $3.5 million. Its loan balance in August was $13.2 million, according to Trepp. The One University Place office building on University Drive in Durham with a starting bid of $900,000. Its loan balance was $3.6 million in August, according to Trepp. The West Park Place building, number 3, retail building on North Carolina 55 in Cary with a starting bid of $800,000. Its loan balance was $3.67 million in August, according to Trepp. The Gallery Park 2 office building on Wake Forest Road in North Raleigh with a starting bid of $750,000. Its loan balance was $2.7 million in August, according to Trepp. Complaints against lawyers in North Carolina at highest since 2004. This next article is by Chris Bagley from Raleigh. Complaints against lawyers are on the rise, and people who follow the legal profession say the cause is at least in part a reflection of a weak economy in which more financially strained clients lose court cases or see their businesses head south. Grievances filed with the North Carolina State Bar are on track to reach 1,550 by the end of the year, the highest annual total since 2004. That total includes a range of potential offenses from federal felony convictions to alleged ethical breaches that result in reprimands but don't necessarily wind up in court or involve payouts. Separately, the number of legal malpractice lawsuits involving Lawyers Mutual Liability Insurance Company of North Carolina appear likely to approach 400 for a fourth straight year, after years in the 300 range. A clear majority of both categories are resolved without attorneys being found responsible for any wrongdoing. For people at the State Bar, a quasi-governmental organization that has the power to reprimand, suspend, and disbar attorneys, the increase in grievances appears to reflect a difficult economy and personal failings of the sorts that can affect anyone in difficult times. In many more instances, particularly in lawsuits against attorneys, legal experts say it probably reflects dissatisfying outcomes in a moribund economy. It's likely that the bad economy has had a role, says Bernie Burke, a former defense attorney in legal malpractice cases who now teaches legal ethics at UNC Chapel Hill's law school. In hard times, people's affairs go badly. Their businesses fail. Their transactions don't go through, and they may be inclined to blame the lawyers that were involved. The State Bar received 1,062 official grievances between January 1 and September 5, putting the total on track to reach 1,557 by the end of the year. That total would be more than the 1,389 filed in 2009 and 1,489 in 2010. The annual total topped 1,900 in 2003. Formal grievances filed by clients became more rare after mid-decade when the State Bar set up a sort of ombudsman program known as the Attorney-Client Assistance Program, says Catherine Jean, counsel with the bar. Really, what people who call us want is that they want the attorney-client relationship to be successful, Jean says. Recent disciplinary actions by the bar include a 3-year suspension of Kimberly Jordan, a Raleigh attorney who said she billed clients for services she hadn't actually rendered, and a censure of another prominent Raleigh lawyer, John T. Orcutt, whose advertisements misled clients. Censure, a sort of stern reprimand, most often follows when an attorney fails to represent a client with reasonable diligence or engages in dishonest conduct that the State Bar finds to harm the professional's integrity. A large volume of litigation filed by clients against attorneys since the mid-2000s has involved real estate transactions. At Lawyers Mutual, which insures more than two-thirds of North Carolina attorneys in private practice, 42% of the 143 claims resolved last year were related to real estate work, down from half in some recent years. The insurer said 26 of the 143 claims resulted in payments to the claimants. Lawyers Mutual President Dan Zurich cites expertise as a key factor. While the claims arising out of transactional practices appear to be trending downward, we are now beginning to experience an uptick in claims involving lawyers practicing outside their usual areas of expertise, Zurich says. We anticipate this trend will continue. Next up, Triangle labor market up a tad, 0.1% through July, by Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. The Triangle continues to grow in terms of labor force expansion, at least through July it did, but not by much. With Wake County leading the way, the Triangle's labor force grew by 0.1% in the 12 months ending in July. That's an additional 2,947 jobs, taking the total jobs in the region to 680,773, up by 699 compared to July 2010. Wake's gain offset a combined loss of 2,245 jobs in Durham and Orange counties. While the regional gain was modest at best, it is a bright spot in North Carolina as the state continues to struggle to recover from the Great Recession. In a healthy economy, a labor force, defined as the number of people either working or looking for work, rises. The North Carolina labor force, for example, grew by more than 7% in the 3.5 years prior to December 2007, which is when the recession formally began. In 43 months between December 2007 and July 2011, the latest data is available, North Carolina has lost 1.3% of its labor force. That represents nearly 60,000 workers who stopped looking for jobs, packed up and moved, or found sources of income off of the books. Since August 2009, when the recession was declared at an end, July 2011, the Tar Heel labor force eroded by 0.8%, or just above 37,000 people. The lost income this represents has consequences for the individuals involved and for the communities they live in, says labor market analyst John Quintero of Chapel Hill-based South by North Strategies. As of July, the share of adult persons in North Carolina with jobs was 55.6%, the lowest level since 1976. The state jobless rate was 5% in late 2007, and as of July, it stood at 10.1%. Labor market shrinkage has been evident in 64 of North Carolina's 100 counties in recent months, according to state figures. Hickory, Morganton, still heavily dependent on manufacturing, has lost about 3% of its labor force in the past year. Goldsboro is down about 2%. Charlotte's labor force contracted by 0.4% in the 12 months ending in July. The Piedmont Triad, on the other hand, scratched out labor force growth of 0.2% for the same period, while Rocky Mount put up growth of 2.6%. Along with labor force shrinkage, another characteristic of the current downturn is the increasing length of time people are remaining unemployed. In December 2007, average unemployment duration was 13.7 weeks. Now it's 18.1, says Alexander F. Sirota of North Carolina Justice Center. Nearly half of the state's workers, without jobs, have been unemployed for more than 6 months, she says in a new study, adding, when workers are without work for more than 6 months, it's not just a drain on their families, but also a drag on economic recovery. Quintero, for one, says he sees nothing on the horizon that would lead to a jobs recovery. UNC Charlotte economist John Connaughton is also making modest predictions for the remainder of the year. For 2011, North Carolina establishments are expected to gain only 23,600 net jobs, more than the 2010 level, he says in a new forecast. The 2011 job gains followed the loss of more than 320,000 jobs during the 2008 and 2009 recession. Continuing on, Cary may spend up to $5 million on a Wake Med soccer park. By Jason DeBrun. From Cary. The town of Cary is moving ahead with an ambitious project to pour as much as $5 million into renovating and expanding the Wake Med Soccer Park in hopes of making it a destination for major events, including NCAA championship tournaments. Bids are being solicited to add 3,000 seats as well as possible VIP suites and other amenities. When finished, the stadium would hold 10,000 spectators. Bids are due September 27th with an estimated project cost of $3.8 million, though Cary has given a cost range of $3 million to $5 million. From 2003 to 2010, the park hosted either the Men's or Women's College Cup, the NCAA Soccer Championship weekend. The park lost those tournaments this year after renovations requested by the NCAA were not made. Cary has submitted a bid to host the college championships again and hopes to get those and other championships back after the renovations, says William Davis, Cary's athletic manager. The complex has hosted various high school championships and is home to the Carolina Railhawks minor league team. The town would pay for the renovation out of its general fund, but is in line to receive $10 million from Wake County's 6% hotel occupancy tax to fund the soccer park and other athletic facilities, Davis says. Cary was initially allocated $10 million from that fund for an aquatic center in 2005, but after it did not immediately build the center, it gave the money back for other projects around the county with the understanding it would get the money back. Scott Dupree, Vice President for Sports Marketing at the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau, says soccer already brings a lot of visitors to the Triangle. The Capital Area Soccer League hosts youth soccer tournaments the same weekends as the ACC and NCAA championships. CASL Castle attracts more than 1,000 teams over 4 weeks. The College Cup itself does not bring much money to the Triangle, accounting for an economic impact of only about $350,000, Dupree says, but combined with the youth tournaments, the impact is much larger. Last year, the Triangle felt a $2.9 million economic impact on just one of the 4 weekends it hosted youth tournaments and posted more than 12,000 hotel room nights that weekend, says Dupree. In addition, some 900 college coaches came to Raleigh to scout prospective college players, says Charlie Slagle, Castle Chief Executive. Having the soccer college championship is more about branding, Dupree says, which attracts the youth soccer teams from around the country. It really was a perfect fit, Dupree says. We really need to get the College Cup back. That's a high priority for us. Upgrades could impact a naming rights deal as well. 4 years ago, the Wake Med Health and Hospitals agreed to a 3-year naming rights contract for $900,000. It renewed the deal for 1 year for $125,000. Now the hospital system and Cary are back in talks for a potential long-term deal. At the same time, Carey is in discussions with the Railhawks for a long-term deal to keep the team at the park. The hospital does not make any operations or facilities decisions involving the soccer or park. It's purely a naming rights deal, says Deborah Lowry, Wake Med Vice President of Public Relations. Now, Raleigh boosters hope Red Hat injects hip into downtown. By Monica Chin. From Raleigh. The announcement that Red Hat intends to relocate to downtown Raleigh has local business leaders abuzz about the impact the open source company could have on the Central District's tech and creative space scenes. The influx of 600 of Red Hat's employees and the promised hiring of 550 more would boost the restaurant and retail business in the area. Also, business owners and officials familiar with the company's meritocratic culture says that having Red Hat downtown could help usher in a rush of creativity. This is such a coup for Raleigh. It's the kind of thing that has helped put Seattle on the map to have Amazon and Microsoft, says Joanne Rode, founder and CEO of healthcare tech company Axial Exchange. Rode is a former Red Hat chief operating officer and director of health IT strategy. As with those at some other major tech companies in the Triangle, some of Red Hat's companies' employees have gone on to found other businesses, and much of what they take away from the company is the culture. Red Hat is about creating a culture where it is based on a meritocracy, where misfits are not only welcomed but celebrated, said David Burney, founder and CEO of Newkind, a new media company that provides holistic consultancy on a company's branding and self-image. It was truly a purpose-driven company with real values and leadership that made sure great ideas can come from anywhere, and that's what creative people want, Burney says. They want meaningful work. They want the freedom to do the right thing, and they want to be recognized for that. Newkind is working with the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce on a recruiting effort funded by Wake County's $50,000 incentives to Red Hat to build an open-source ecosystem in downtown Raleigh to entice the creative class. Red Hat representatives declined to discuss the company's culture for this story. Unlike in downtown Durham, where a critical mass has been achieved with tech startups on the American Tobacco campus, and northward in the city center and Central Park areas in downtown Raleigh, many of the startups have been in separate clusters. For instance, Axial Exchange is located in Glenwood South, and Newkind is located off Hillsborough Street. Red Hat, which intends to move to Progress Energy's building at the corner of Wilmington and Davie Streets, would be more in the William Square District, Moore Square District, an area downtown that includes art space and the Marble Kids Museum and IMAX Theater. We haven't had that critical mass in one location. I think Red Hat will serve as a centering force for the tech firms, says Rode. Another way in which downtown Raleigh's tech scene could emerge differently from downtown Durham's is that while Durham tech startups have been founded by many serial entrepreneurs and software developers, companies that have come out of Red Hat have been founded by former executives. Both Rode and Burney are former Red Hat executives, and RPath, a Raleigh cloud applications engine provider, was founded by Eric Trone, former vice president of product engineering and chief developer of Red Hat. Red Hat supports the open-source community by providing the office space to the Triangle Linux Group to hold its monthly meetings, and many members of the organization have been hired by the company. Other open-source communities growing in the area include City Camp Raleigh and Splatspace. Christopher Hively, director of Triangle Startup Factory, an incubator that's raising money for early-stage companies, has been speaking with Raleigh officials interested in creating the same tech scene as in American Tobacco. However, since much of the startup energy in Durham is coming up from ground-level software developers, Hively wonders about the extent of the impact of Red Hat's move. People who are starting companies are software developers, know enough about Linux to do what they need to get accomplished, Hively says. But if Red Hat helps some of that social fabric, that gluing together in downtown Raleigh, that could be a good thing. One thing for sure is that Red Hat's move from NC State University's Centennial Campus will be felt. In terms of employment, Red Hat is the biggest company on the campus and has been a supporter of various initiatives. The company helped found the campus, acquire $5.9 million in federal appropriations for the Secure Open Systems Initiative, and built and maintains the 2,500-square-foot OSCR Laboratory, or Open Systems Collaboration and Research Laboratory, which would have cost the university more than $1 million to build on its own, says Centennial Director Dennis Kikas. We are optimistic that they will continue to be a supporter of the university in these kinds of activities, he says. There's a long timeline for them to make their transition. Red Hat signed a non-binding letter of intent to sublease the Progress Energy building through the end of Progress's current lease, which is 2034. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. B Corp, as in socially beneficial. For-profit companies that have the twin purposes of maximizing shareholder value and making a positive social impact could be incorporated in North Carolina under a bill the state Senate approved unanimously this year that now awaits consideration in the NC House. This would broaden the ability of a company to provide societal benefits, says State Senator Richard Stevens, a Kerry Republican who co-sponsored the bill. In permitting the creation of Benefits Corporation, or B Corp, the proposed legislation would adjust the fiduciary duty of boards of directors to allow them to achieve other objectives in conjunction with, not in place of, the maximizing of profits, says A.P. Carlton Jr., a Raleigh lawyer who represents clients considering forming B corporations. Under state law, if directors of a corporation focus on anything other than maximizing profits, they are not fulfilling their primary obligation to shareholders and would be subject to challenge by shareholders, says Carlton, a former president of the American Bar Association. The bill would require the board of a B corporation to include an independent director who would have to certify annually that the company acted according to its public benefit purposes. It would also require a B corporation to prepare an annual report spelling out how it is carrying out its public benefit purpose. Stevens says the bill would make it easier for shareholders who want to invest in companies not only to make a profit, but also for the good purpose being conducted by the company as well. Carlton says the bill provides an alternative to entrepreneurs who want to develop a social enterprise model without creating a traditional tax-exempt organization regulated by the IRS under Section 501c of the Federal Tax Code, particularly 501c4 community service or social welfare organizations, such as those related to chambers of commerce or utility companies. Characterizing the bill as pro-business because it allows flexibility for boards of directors in determining corporate objectives, he said if the bill does not become law, he would advise aspiring B corporations to incorporate in another state with laws that allow them. Kevin Trapani, president and CEO of the Redwoods Group, says the bill would create jobs because by relaxing restrictions in the current law that inhibits socially responsible companies from engaging in activities other than those that focus on maximizing shareholder value, it would remove risk to raising growth capital. Under current law, an organization that is built to recognize a balance of interest between multiple stakeholders, including shareholders, but also customers, employees, the environment, the community, puts itself at risk when it makes balanced decisions, he says. By contrast, he says, the proposed legislation will allow community-focused companies to grow by giving them access to capital that aligns with their mission. State Representative Stephen A. LaRouche, a Kinston Republican who chairs the House Rules Committee, says he knows of no opposition to the bill and expects it will get a committee hearing in the short session that begins next May. And now from the editor's notebook, Sougata Mukherjee. Truth about jobs. Over the past 2 weeks, virtually everyone on Wall Street and in Washington has been talking about one thing, jobs for Main Street. President Barack Obama is talking about it, and some senior Wall Street economists, including Stephen Blitz and Alan Sinai, are chiming in through their own magic eight ball, calling for the government to take an active role. But other than talking about how the credit and capital markets are almost impossible to penetrate for small private businesses, all the talk about jobs is either focused on policy or the giant corporations that continue to have mass layoffs. A new report by Chapel Hill-based SageWorks, a financial analysis firm, provides us with enough gunpowder to assert that most of these job-related discussions are misdirected. In order to create jobs, we first have to look at the collective group that has created the majority of the jobs in this country over the past decade, small, privately held businesses. According to SageWorks research, private company sales are expected to grow by almost 7% this year, up substantially from 4% in 2010. One would think that would mean that these businesses must be hiring more workers since they are doing fairly well. Far from the truth. And perhaps this is the most telling part of the jobs discussion. Profit per employee is the highest it's been in decades. For every full-time employee on their payrolls, private companies, on average, are netting more than $15,000. That means if you have 20 employees, your profit should be $300,000. Profit, not sales, mind you. If your company is not registering in these numbers, and if we're to believe these survey results, you may ask your employer to work even harder to bring the bottom line number up. In general, private companies are more profitable today than they were 10 years ago. And remember, 10 years ago was the time following the largest expansion in this nation's economic history. Private businesses, from florists to software developers, will finish 2011 with about 7% net profit margins. In some industries, such as software, these margins may look laughable since gross margins run between 30 and 45%. But if one takes all types of industries, the margins are up more than 30% than what they were before the recent recession. What numbers tell us? Financials are not really the problem when it comes to jobs. Most companies have figured out that they can get more out of their workers, as is evidenced by the surging worker productivity at every level. If there is a real intent from state and federal government to introduce processes that create jobs, they should look at young companies. Give these companies a tax break. Maybe not paying income tax or individuals they hire for a period of 3 years, as long as the same person is employed for a specific time. To make this a balanced approach, perhaps we need to review our tax policy toward multinationals in recent years and try to close the loopholes. We know one thing. Strong companies are not getting stronger by not hiring. What does that tell you? This week's guest opinion is from Charles Klotfelter. He's a professor of public policy, economics, and law at Duke University. Academic mission must come first. Among the urgent topics discussed by more than 50 university presidents at the NCAA retreat last month in Indianapolis was what to do about the apparent epidemic of cheating in big-time college sports. One sports writer opined that there had never been a year with more lying, cheating, poor leadership, and all-around misbehaving, end quote. Institutions including Auburn, Connecticut, LSU, Miami, Ohio State, Tennessee, and USC, as well as world-class research universities Michigan and North Carolina, have been implicated in rules violations ranging from excessive practice time and plagiarism to the sale of memorabilia and outright payments to players. Given the well-deserved academic reputations these universities have earned, one might ask, how could they have let this happen? Cheating has been a big part of big-time college sports for a long time. The Carnegie Commission's exhaustive 1929 report on college sports documented numerous violations of recruiting rules. In the 1980s, players at SMU received regular cash payments. A study published in 1991 found that 35% of more than 1,000 football players surveyed had taken illegal payments while they were in college. Last October, Sports Illustrated published an account by a retired sports agent who said he had paid 30 different college football players over his two-decade career. In some cases of rule breaking, the culprits are on a university's payroll. Other cases involve sports agents, family members, or athletic boosters, but universities are penalized if they are found to have been looking the other way. None of the universities penalized by NCAA condones rule breaking, yet those very universities have created incentives and make cheating so tempting. It may sound like blaming the victim, but this is what I have concluded after spending several years studying the role of big-time college sports in America, the only country in the world, by the way, with universities that sponsor commercial sports. What distinguishes universities with big-time sports programs from those that don't is that, in addition to their dedication to teaching, research, and service, they care deeply about having competitive teams, especially in football and basketball. Big-time sports can benefit the academic mission of the universities that sponsor it, including exposure that pays off in bigger applicant pools and stronger support from donors and legislatures. But for these universities, sports success is not just a means to an end. It is an end in itself. Signing those star recruits means pushing the envelope at every edge. For some coaches and athletic directors, it will inevitably mean stepping over the line, which can be facilitated by boosters willing to provide cash, cars, or other inducements. And because it's essential to keep these stars academically eligible once they enroll, there is every incentive to provide overworked and often underpaid and underprepared athletes all the tutoring possible. Rule-breaking also carries reputational risk. Although fans often seem unperturbed by penalties, universities with sparkling academic reputations have a great deal to lose when NCAA investigators come calling, which explains why these universities seldom get in trouble and why there is so much hand-wringing when they do. Rule-breaking in college sports is often viewed strictly in moral terms as a reflection of defective character. But it would be a mistake to ignore the powerful influence of the universities themselves and the incentives they create by attaching such importance to athletic success. Cheating won't be solved by tighter rules and better enforcement. A century of big-time college sports tells us that much. Real change won't happen until university trustees, not just presidents, show they value the academic mission more than winning games. You should know that North Carolina's 211 telephone service is available to 80% of the people in the state to call for local help. A $200,000 grant from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina will help expand that service to the 40 counties without the service. Not to be confused with 911, 211 services offer people information about access to health and human services within their local communities. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.